Hi, everyone. It's Ryan Hoover, your host of Product Hunt Radio, where I'm joined by the founders, investors, and makers that are shaping the future of tech. Today, I'm visiting Stripe's office in San Francisco to chat with Patrick Collison and Cortland Allen, shortly after they announced their latest round of funding, valuing the company at a whopping $20 billion. Patrick is a CEO and co-founder of Stripe, an ambitious company set out to increase the GDP of the internet. The now 1,300-person company was started in 2010 by Patrick and his brother, John Collison, at the age of 23 and 21, respectively. While young, this wasn't their first startup. Prior to founding Stripe, Patrick and his brother started and sold Octomatic for $5 million in 2008. Cortland is a super talented designer and developer. In 2016, he founded Indie Hackers, an awesome community of bootstrappers and makers sharing their stories. And then 9 months later, Stripe acquired the company. Cortland is a Y Combinator alumni and MIT graduate with a degree in computer science as well. On the show, we talk about why Stripe started a book publishing business in 2018, the importance of meetups when building online communities, and how role models can help build a more inclusive tech ecosystem. But before we jump in, I want to give a shout out to our sponsors. We'd like to thank Airtable for making the show possible. I've been talking with a diverse mix of companies that use Airtable to build their business, including Ryan Delk, COO at Omni.
Thanks for coming on.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Ryan.
Tell me more about Omni.
We're building the future of how people will own and access things.
If you were to describe Airtable in a single word, what would you use?
I feel like superpowers. I really feel like every time we move something from a Google Sheet or an Excel file into Airtable, I truly feel like I have superpowers and I can learn more from the data, do more with it, share it more easily, collaborate with more people. It helps me unlock so much more value from what I'm working on, even though the actual data or whatever I'm looking at isn't any different. It's just the interface and the power of all the different things you can do, from like building a true relational database around stuff. You don't even feel like you're interacting with a database. And then you get, you know, an hour in and you realize, oh, I've been building a relational database for the last hour, but I've just felt like I was intuitively, you know, sort of using this app that helped me, you know, organize this information.
You can get $50 in free credit by visiting airtable.com/producthunt. Intercom, one of the tools we've been using since the very beginning of Product Hunt, is a tool we use for outbound messaging, but also to power our support and really help our community. We, of course, have people all around the world messaging us 24/7, and thankfully we have Intercom to answer a lot of those questions. So I have Jake here, head of support at Product Hunt, to tell us more about how we're using Intercom to manage all of those requests at scale.
We use Intercom for our live chat support on the site. The team is there and available to talk to users, but we're not always online. And with Intercom, we actually have the ability to set up and use their operator bot, which pulls in suggestions from our help center, which is also hosted by Intercom, and suggest articles related to what the users are asking about, which is extremely beneficial for the users, which helps them save time and get answers to the questions as fast as possible, and helps us focus and take that data of what the users are asking about and searching for and help improve our help center and help improve aspects of our site to deliver the best experience possible.
What have we learned so far with some of the data? I know that all of the articles are measured in terms of traffic and engagement on all of them. What kind of interesting insights have you learned?
Certain things, like, you know, we'll launch a new feature and sometimes we're extremely close to something and we kind of understand how it works. But if a user is searching for a specific keyword, we can take that information and realize that there might be some data we need to tweak on our side, or the help article itself might need to be changed to help make it a bit more readable and understandable.
Visit intercom.com to give it a try. Hey everybody, this is Ryan Hoover on Product Hunt Radio. I'm at Stripe. We have a couple cool people here. We have Patrick and Cortland. How's it going, guys?
Pretty good. How's it going, Ryan?
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, Patrick, you are making a makeshift microphone holder here on top of a book.
Well, we're a startup, so gotta improvise.
A startup that just raised a bunch of money.
We're a startup that's trying to go global. And so Stripe is kind of directly available in 20...
7 now countries today. I mean, through Atlas, we now work with companies in more than 100 countries, but we sort of want to directly make Stripe's services available in, you know, I mean, there are about 200 countries. We would like, in principle, Stripe's services to be available in all of them. And unfortunately, that is expensive.
Yeah, I bet. And you also have 9 offices across the world, I believe.
Yes, 9 and increasing. Yeah. And we're now hiring engineers sort of not only in San Francisco, which we've been doing for quite a while, but also in Seattle and Singapore and in Dublin. And so we're sort of, you know, rather than pursuing this kind of traditional model of tech companies where you kind of have this sort of citadel somewhere in the Bay Area or maybe Seattle, and then you kind of have these sort of satellite offices that are sort of far less significant, we're really trying to kind of decentralize our development into these kind of 4 global hubs. And so we're excited about that.
Nice. So I'd actually love to dive into that. But first, let's talk a little about Indie Hackers. Cortland, do you want to give a background, just quick story on what is Indie Hackers, how to start, all of that?
Yeah. So Indie Hackers is a community of entrepreneurs and aspiring entrepreneurs who are helping each other build online businesses. So the journey of someone who wants to start a business has always been kind of solitary. If you want to start a company, really most of the examples that you can learn from are hard to identify with, I would say. So the prototypical startup is started by a couple of geniuses from MIT or Harvard who've moved to the Bay Area and raised a ton of venture capital and get a ton of tech press.
Because that's the only way to build a real successful company.
It's the only way to build a real successful company, and everything else is not a real successful world-changing company. But if you are more focused on, let's say, changing your own life, achieving some sort of financial independence or freedom, then the examples we learn from are few and far between. And it can seem like it's something that's really not even a path for you to go down. And so Indie Hackers started by me interviewing 10 or 15 people who were doing just that, just working from their basement, building a revenue-generating company with not necessarily global, you know, world-changing ambitions, but the ambition to change their own life. And everybody that I interview shares their revenue numbers, how they came up with their idea, how they marketed and grown their product, how they wrote their first lines of code, and the things they've learned along the way so that other people who are reading can be inspired and learn how to do the same things.
Yeah. And Indie Hackers acquired by Stripe, when was that? A couple years ago?
April 2017, so a year and a half ago.
Oh, wow. So how did that happen?
I'll just interject briefly and say that I'd been sort of a reader of and an admirer of Indie Hackers for, I guess, most of its history, because I think it launched about 9-ish months before then, right? And I guess I hadn't sort of known sort of that that's exactly how Cortland was thinking of it. It really sort of jumped out to me because it was so different. I mean, for sort of precisely the reasons Cortland mentions, where so much of sort of our discourse and our discussion of startups is oriented around funding, and it's kind of, you know, either you're sort of on this inexorable trajectory to be this kind of celestial success, or somehow, you know, things are decrepit and dissolving and falling apart. And there are these sort of extraordinarily important stories around sort of people who are carefully, methodically, prudently, disciplinedly building these sort of amazing businesses and to sort of really, I think, significant, you know, personal success. But because their trajectories aren't as wild, they don't get as much attention.
Because it's not a unicorn. It's not.
Yeah. And there isn't like crazy shit happening. It's not like, you know, either this overnight sort of explosion or this overnight implosion. It's just sort of, you know, month by month, sort of one foot after another. And I think our role models really matter, and the sort of the archetypes and the sort of examples that we kind of have to point to. And so I thought Indie Hackers was and still is doing really valuable work around making clear that there is another way. And I think these were just kind of very oddly untold stories.
Yeah. Actually, I have a question for you. Did you have role models as a young entrepreneur before Stripe? Maybe were there role models, maybe entrepreneurially or professionally, that you looked up to?
Yeah. No, I think, again, I think role models really matter. And for me, I mean, I guess Silicon Valley in some broad sense provided sort of a, you know, plethora of role models. I mean, Founders at Work is a book that kind of sticks out because I guess it was a book that was kind of specifically focused on that. But I mean, a lot of the standard stuff that I think, you know, inspired many of us, you know, Steve Jobs and kind of in different ways, Bill Gates and Larry and Sergey at Google and so on.
Did you, Corlin, have some role models that you looked up to, or was it just more, I don't know, you were your own role model?
I had a lot of role models, actually, and a lot of them were themselves Indie Hackers. And so before I started Indie Hackers, I participated in an online community called Hacker News quite a lot. And it was pretty common for people to share these stories of how they were starting a one-person online business, how much money they were making, et cetera. And you'd see the same names pop up over and over again. So John O'Nolan from Ghost, sort of a WordPress competitor. Peter Levels of Nomadlist is a very vocal figure in sort of the Indie Hacker community. And I really looked up to what they had done as well.
I'll actually say, I guess it was kind of some entrepreneurship role models, and there were kind of technical role models, the Alan Kays and the John Carmacks and the Fabrice Ballards and, you know, all these folks. And I always felt a bit sort of torn as kind of, you know, who do I want to be when I grow up? I think Stripe in some way is sort of, it's not exactly a middle path, but I don't know, at least was, you know, influenced by sort of elements of both.
So Stripe, seems like a lot has happened over the past 2-3 years, and you've expanded. Of course, Indie Hackers has come on board. You now publish books, which honestly was a surprise, but kind of in hindsight, I kind of get now, you know, at least I think I get why you're doing that. You have Atlas. I know I'm missing a few different things. Kind of how can you kind of describe the last few years and how you've expanded the platform and the offering?
We sort of think about it in, well, you can divide it up a whole bunch of different ways, but so one way to think about it would be there are things that cause more companies to get started. Then there's sort of core infrastructure that sort of actually helps, you know, a company become a business and helps them accept payments and so on. And then there's kind of additional products and services that we can provide sort of once that business exists and is up and running. And so, I mean, we obviously provide sort of, you know, this payments functionality. It's incredibly important to us. We invest a huge amount in it. It's probably kind of where by a significant margin most of our focus goes. And sort of we think of this as our sort of global payments and kind of treasury network, right? And that's, again, kind of what Stripe is known for. And then, as you kind of point out, we've been building these sort of additional things like Sigma or our billing infrastructure or Connect for marketplaces. And, you know, these sort of products enable businesses to either do things that were kind of impossible before or just do things that were previously sort of a huge pain, right? And so kind of, you know, there was this kind of ecosystem of sort of recurring billing tools that sort of made it possible for businesses to implement these various subscription models. And like, they weren't bad, but they kind of weren't, you know, deeply integrated, and they didn't necessarily work in all the markets or support all the payment methods or whatever, right? And so we see a lot of value to kind of integrating that directly with Stripe. The part that I think is generally kind of underserved by companies, and you know, maybe it applies, you know, to a unique extent to Stripe, is we think a lot about this question of kind of what determines how many startups are even started in the first place, right? Because that determines so much of sort of our long-term market. And I think it's interesting to think about, you know, some of the stuff we're talking about, some of these role models, the existence of Hacker News, the existence of Y Combinator, the existence of the seed funding ecosystem, etc. And I think all of those things sort of in different ways increase the number of companies that got started because they inspired people to do so. They communicated the sense that it was possible. They made clear you didn't have to be this kind of astonishing, magically endowed person. You know, you didn't have to sort of get a letter from Hogwarts. You could just do it. And
we are, by the way, in the Harry Potter room. That
is true. Yeah.
Hence the reference.
But we didn't have to get a letter from Hedwig. I think it's very important. And so in different ways, Indie Hackers and Atlas and Stripe Press and some of these other efforts are sort of oriented around this question of how do we help increase the number of sort of successful companies that get started in the world? Because that's not a cosmological constant. I think it can be increased. And if it can be increased, then I think it's an incredibly valuable thing to go and do that. And it's not even, you know, necessarily that expensive. I mean, it's not like it's sort of cheap to do Atlas or cheap to publish books, whatever. But I mean, it's not like a $1 billion undertaking. And so it really feels worthwhile. I think it can be, you know, an sort of ROI positive thing for us, but more importantly, incredibly impactful in the world.
Yeah. As you might assume, is I'm very much pro entrepreneurship. I've grew up with two entrepreneurial parents myself. And generally speaking, I think I would love to see more people work on their passions and be able to pay their rent with their passions. And entrepreneurship is certainly one path towards that. And the good thing is we now have technology and infrastructure to be able to build something as a single person. Like Cortland, you were and still largely are all of Indie Hackers, right? From a technical perspective. And
right. My brother joined up after I joined Stripe, but I write the code. He does most of the written interviews.
But I think that's one of the most ridiculous just facts about sort of Indie Hackers that, you know, so many people ask me sort of how big is that team and like, you know, what's their design team like and you know, how exactly, what's the sort of back-end infrastructure behind the podcast and all the rest. And so the fact that Indie Hackers is Cortland and Channing, and that's like engineering and podcasting and interviewing and design and community management and everything else that goes into, I mean, the whole community, that has not ceased to be remarkable.
Yeah. No, it's rare. You usually see people try to take on funding and hire a bunch of people. And like on the product team, we're certainly bigger. We're 19 and we're experimenting with a lot of other things. But having known how difficult it is to build a community, I'm like incredibly impressed. It's like basically you and your brother.
Thanks. Would not have been possible, I think, 10 or 15 years ago.
Yeah.
And I think also Indie Hackers, like the movement in general, would not have been as possible 10 or 15 years ago, because there's so much more knowledge being exchanged now, so many more tools to help build things. It's just easier to do with a small team than it ever has been.
I mean, same thing with the Product Hunt too. If we were 10 years ago, like how many products, how many interesting products would launch every single day?
we might have to switch to like a weekly leaderboard or something. It just would have been a very different type of engagement and ecosystem. And our entire bet is that we'll see more and more products launch and more people get into technology and fiddle and tinker with different ideas. Yeah. So so the book publishing is the interesting kind of, a lot of the other things make very clear sense. And you're obviously a heavy reader. How many books do you read normally, Patrick?
I'm definitely not the heaviest reader at Stripe. And I know of some people who read more than I do. And I'm certain there are people who, also read much more, and I just don't know that fact. I mean, I probably read one or two books a week, which
seems like a lot to me.
I mean, there are people at Stripe whose batting average is much closer to a book a day. So,
Are they cheating? Are they doing Audible?
I don't think so. I think they're just the sort of at the intersection of very interested in books and have this sort of gift of being able to plow through them quickly. Like, I'm not a speed reader.
Yeah, me either. It's called Stripe Press. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Yeah. How does that play in?
Okay. So one thing is, it seems like books matter a lot in the world, right? People often talk about books as being things that have been very influential for them, as things that have held, material significance in their lives, whatever, right? And so, hypothesis one, books matter. Kind of observation is that the publishing industry has some kind of, strange dynamics, or not strange, but just kind of important dynamics, where there's kind of academic publishers, and sort of they have their own kind of incentives and motivations and so on. They generally don't care that much about kind of the breadth of dissemination of ideas. That's just kind of not what kind of the success of academic books. That's not the benchmark. And then for kind of mass market books and so the big publishing houses, I mean, they obviously necessarily their businesses, they care about revenue. And they also kind of care about sort of novelty to some degree, as in, there isn't a ton of kind of republishing of old books that happens, right? And which is kind of part of caring about revenue, because republishing old stuff is just probably not that profitable. And so our kind of instinct was that there might then be kind of a whole bunch of books that sort of don't quite get the attention they deserve, because there isn't just like a natural outlet that would sort of lead to their publication. And so with Stripe Press, the kind of binding idea is to,
pun intended,
to surface and kind of publish and put forward books that are kind of in some way oriented around this question of, as we phrase it, ideas for progress, but sort of things that will be in some way useful as people try to think about how to do something novel, how to build something important, how to kind of contribute to sort of the general welfare. But we're kind of doing that in a slightly different way, where we're totally fine with republishing stuff that's been published elsewhere before. Stubborn Attachments, which we just published, was previously available as a super long Medium post. And so, we're not kind of first to make it available. I have no idea how well it'll sell, but, I think there's a lot of kind of interesting and important ideas there. Or The Dream Machine, which we also just published. Alan Kay called it the best history of the genesis of the internet and the kind of origins of the technology industry, kind of was available but out of print. And again, that just kind of really felt like an inefficiency to us. And so as we look at all those, we're like, well, there are ideas here that are important. And kind of as previously discussed, I think ideas matter, but it does not seem to be a profitable niche for anybody else to operate in. And so, perhaps by sort of not being as revenue oriented as traditional publishers, we can sort of cause some good in the world. And it's not that we don't care at all about revenue. I mean, we want these books to sell. We want them to be popular, but that's not like the single metric for us.
Yeah.
And it again comes back to this idea of how do we grow the GDP of the internet and how do we support economic growth. And, perhaps one of these books can be something that sort of causes somebody to care about the internet in a, in a new way, or to kind of see the importance of building things for others. And perhaps through that, they then kind of stumble upon indie hackers and they sort of start to get a more tactile sense for like, okay, how to do something. And then perhaps, a year or two later, they become kind of successful sort of customers of Stripe. But I think it's important sort of not to look at the sort of the human capital of the world as something that's fixed, but instead actually fairly mutable.
This podcast is brought to you by Stripe. The best way to know if people like your product is if they'll actually pay for it. But collecting payments on the internet is harder than you might think. Stripe makes it easy for entrepreneurs to turn their ideas into businesses by helping them accept money from anyone, anywhere in the world. So if you're building an internet company and you care about revenue, you should check out Stripe.com.
When is the Indie Hackers book coming out? it's such a great brand, and you already have so many stories. It's like you have the material, infrastructure.
We've got like 400 stories online, 70 podcast episodes. I think a coffee table book or something would be really cool. No date on that as of yet.
Yeah.
But Probably one day.
The Indie Hacker stories are quite amazing. I mean, obviously the site is sort of very popular and a lot of people sort of are already enjoying them. But I guess I wondered myself, you know, will they ever start to feel old? But somehow each story is so unique. And sort of the particulars of, you know, the origin and sort of what exactly they're doing are in each case so different that I don't know, it really works.
I think it's if a reader can grasp onto some sort of commonality, and this goes back to the role models conversation. I thought about my own upbringing, and I mentioned before my parents are entrepreneurs and they were my role models, and it was really clear and sort of a natural step in evolution for me to experiment. And as a kid, my parents equipped me with opportunities to, you know, work at the video game store my parents owned, and they supported me in buying and selling on eBay and all of that. And it was because my parents were there to like show me that this is a possibility. And I think with Indie Hackers, when you have these different stories, it's like if it could be simply the way that someone looks, like someone that they look like me and they did this and they found some success. And that alone could be something that people grasp onto.
They're from the same country that I'm from. We have an Indie Hackers meetup in Lagos, Nigeria. And it's like 10 people in Lagos get together every month and meet up. And it's like many of those people have never met another Indie Hacker. And so for that to be something that they can actually do on a regular basis is tremendously inspiring.
Yeah. How are the meetups going?
Meetups are going great. So I was just at a meetup in Boston yesterday, and there were 10 people there who were super excited to be part of Indie Hackers. There was a meetup in, I think, Tel Aviv, Israel last night with 50 people. I'm going to be going to an Atlanta meetup later this month. I think we have like 40 or 50 meetups happening every month, hopefully closer to 100 by the end of the year.
Why do meetups matter so much? As in, you know, they can peruse all this content on the site and, you know, a lot of the information is there. Why is IRL important?
Yeah.
And why is it not in VR? Like, I mean, do we really need to meet in person?
Yeah. Give us another few years. I think, you know, when we talk about inspiration, you talking about meeting people who are somewhat from a similar background as you and how impactful that can be. I think the tangibility of an actual meetup, actually talking to someone across from you and actually seeing like, okay, this is a person who's really doing it. It's real. I can do that. And being able to have a conversation with someone makes it much more down to earth and realistic. So you can read a story about someone on the internet doing something and say, okay, well, here's like, you know, 50 reasons why that person is different from me and why I can never do that. And it doesn't really give you sort of the kick in the ass to get started. But when you sit there and talk to someone, even someone like, you know, Patrick, who's incredibly impressive and in person is also incredibly impressive, but talking to you like makes you a real person. And the things that you've done now seem more attainable to other people.
So yes, I can definitely be a demonstration for people that you do not have to be anything all that remarkable.
But yeah, the meetups are they're great. There's a lot of energy. There's some practical problems as well that I think meetups help people solve. For example, it's much easier to find, for example, a co-founder to work with in person that you feel like you vibe with and you get along with than it is to do on the internet. So a lot of people find co-founders in Indie Hackers meetups.
Would you have started Indie Hackers if you had not sort of gone to or somehow had, like, was there some kind of analogous sort of in-person, I don't know, communication or sort of tangible examples you had that were kind of important for you?
I mean, I live in San Francisco, which is like startup
no,
capital.
No, of the no world. Shortage of tangible examples.
Right. Probably not the best place in terms of cost to bootstrap a business, but in terms of actual inspirational people around, it's great. I went through Y Combinator as well many years before that. And so I've had no shortage of people that I could talk to in person. And I think it's been very real for me since the day I got here that this is something that can be done by anyone.
Have there been any awesome stories that have come out of any of the meetups so far?
So last night I talked to a guy who told me that Indie Hackers had changed his entire life and that without Indie Hackers, he would not have quit his job. He met his co-founder at an Indie Hackers meetup. He started his business and he's now, I think, found a few customers. And I've heard stories like that at pretty much every meetup. I've met a lot of people who have come to meetups and they have actually started meetups because they were going to be traveling to a particular city and they just wanted to meet others like them. And then they put out, you know, the call for a meetup on the Indie Hackers website and 40, 50 people showed up.
Oh, it's a great way for someone to actually build a network and connect with like-minded people is like start a meetup in your city.
Exactly. Or if you're traveling anywhere, like if you want to talk to like-minded people, you know, you're going to be in a country by yourself and you're not sure what to do, you can start an Indie Hackers meetup and guarantee there'll be 5-10 people who are interested in the same things that you're interested in, who are from that country.
It's like CrossFit for entrepreneurship.
Yeah. It's a little bit of a cult.
Less sweaty, maybe. Yeah, right. Less dangerous.
Yeah, less dangerous.
Hopefully fewer physical injuries. Right. Interesting. What's the most surprising challenge that Indie Hackers face when they start? You know, like, I don't know, maybe building the product, you know, is hard, but you expect it to be hard. What's the most like surprising thing that's hard?
I think it's surprising to me, and maybe this is just to me because like this is my first full-time job ever. I've never had a full-time job before Stripe, but it's surprisingly stress-causing for people to consider quitting their jobs. And you don't have to quit your job to start a business. A lot of people are surprised to hear that and like pleasantly surprised to hear that. But again, I was talking to somebody at the Boston meetup last night and she was contemplating quitting her job and in fact had already quit her job once before and then had gone back after a few months and was ready to do the same thing again. And that's something I hear again about over and over again.
So I Product Hunt started as a side project while I was employed somewhere else. And I eventually switched to a part-time role. I was really fortunate to be able to do that and, you know, float in San Francisco. But it would have been very difficult for me to leave and live in San Francisco because I just didn't have much in savings, really, and start a company. And so I've heard that a lot, too, where people feel like they have to quit. They have to quit because that's what real founders do. And the reality is you can just experiment. You can tinker, you know, assuming that you have the flexibility with your family and whatnot.
Yeah. I've heard a lot of really creative stories as well. Like there is an Indie Hackers podcast episode coming out today, actually, with an entrepreneur named Christy Lawrence. So she's from New Zealand. She moved to Australia and she wanted to start a business, but she knew nothing about internet startups. She didn't know that fundraising was a thing. So she didn't even contemplate raising money. So she's like, I have to build this myself. She wasn't a developer. And so she traded her expertise in marketing to a development shop and they built her app for them while she did marketing for their product and like got her thing built. And like 2 years in, she's doing $1 million a year in revenue. So it's like very inspirational story, but her path to get there is extremely unconventional.
Do you think there should be more or less funding in the world?
More funding, but more spread out. And ideally, I think more evenly distributed rather than like, you know, Stripe, $200 million. $1 million to 200 different people, I think would be great. Some of the problems that I'd love for Indie Hackers to help people solve is more funding for their businesses, more, I guess, help with hiring for their businesses, especially Indie Hacker businesses have a lot of trouble hiring. And also like people who need to exit and sell their companies. I think that would be an interesting thing for Indie Hackers to sort of help with.
If Indie Hackers businesses are raising money, what's the definition of indie over time?
It's funny because people have asked me this from the beginning. People have complained about people that I've had on the podcast or on the website not being true indie hackers. And so I put the definition of indie hackers on the website probably 2 weeks after I started the website and I made it as broad as possible just so I had a fallback. But I think an indie hacker...
It's a state of mind, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's someone who's pursuing, I think, financial independence. So I would say maybe the idea that you will build something that generates revenue that's actually a business that's self-sustaining is sort of the only one, you know, must have. Other than that, you can be a developer or non-developer. You can raise money or you cannot raise money. Prototypical indie hacker is self-funded as a developer and is building an online business, but it doesn't have to be that way.
What do you think about that question you asked? Should there be more funding or less in startups and in technology companies?
I basically agree with Cortland that I think the sort of marginal product of sort of the additional dollar in the sort of startup centers of the world is pretty low. And you see that both in terms of, I mean, it's not like here in the Bay Area that like if you have a good idea, sort of not only will it be possible to raise money, but sort of, you know, you'll have to bat away investors who are sort of, you know, this like crowding effect around, you know, hot deals and all the rest. I'm always struck when I spend time in other markets at how, I mean, people accuse investors of being lemmings or, you know, kind of way too influenced by others and the crowd and what's hot and all the rest. And I don't think investors are sort of unique in that regard. I think just like people are subject to extremely strong sort of Girardian herd effects. And so just, you know, investors, as almost everyone, I think kind of really indexes on the sort of popular conception of all these things. As a consequence of that, I think that startups and just technology businesses of kind of any flavor outside of the sort of popular hubs are less popular than they ought to be. And people update too slowly based on sort of, you know, changing trends. And that, you know, for example, I was in Singapore last week and I was at an event for companies from sort of across Southeast Asia. And, you know, for the last decade, Southeast Asia has not been a great place to invest. I mean, there have been some successful companies started, but like it hasn't been like a sort of a really big generator of, you know, major technology companies. It really looks like that's going to be sort of quite different for the next 10 years. And already you're seeing companies like Carousel and Grab and Gojek and so on that are sort of starting to kind of spring up and become really major entities. But I think kind of the world tends to sort of, you know, update too slowly in response to that new data. When you're at the sort of, you know, beginning or the end of the S, it's pretty efficient, you know, stuff has been arbitraged out, whereas kind of in that transition zone, that's kind of when the opportunities exist. And so I would say outside of the centers and in the kind of transition periods of those kind of S-curve sigmoids, I think that there are kind of pretty big opportunities there. And I think kind of as a general matter, that means outside of the US and Western Europe.
Yeah. Well, part of the challenge, I think, is that venture is such a long feedback loop. So you invest in a company and if you look at the Midas list, nothing against the people on the list by any means, but they're basically projecting back in the past 5 to 10 years, what is the performance of those investors and who has done the best? It doesn't necessarily reflect the best investor today, though, because we don't actually have data on that. Exactly.
That's right.
Empirical data.
That's right. The best investor operating this year is very plausibly not an A-list.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is kind of wild to think about. Unlike, you know, in Product Hunt, Indie Hackers, Stripe, you push something to production, you launch a product, and sometimes within those hours, days, weeks, you kind of know if it's working or not, or like at least where it's going. Whereas as an investor, you're like, okay, let me sit on this for 3 years.
Well, although I think it's, I know what Gordon thinks, but I think it's actually kind of hard for both of us because the particulars of our business where, you know, sort of we're supporting these companies that take many, many years to mature, right? If you look at some of the kind of biggest businesses on Stripe today, it took them a long time to become big, right? And so kind of when we look at, well, how do we do in, you know, we just started Q4, how do we do in Q3? I mean, we can kind of tell how big the businesses were in Q3, but really the question is how big are they going to be in 10 years' time? And I mean, that reduces to the same problem as VC of sort of this prediction exercise, since it's actually kind of hard for us. And kind of similarly, I think for indie hackers, you know, when you're building a community and you're trying to sort of understand how significant, I mean, because, you know, I mean, you can look at traffic, whatever, but like really the question is, will these people do awesome things in the future? And that's kind of hard to metric around.
It is, but I like that in a way you can do things that are sort of directionally good that you think will have a good impact that you know, even if you can't measure it effectively today, will actually inspire people and educate people and help them build successful companies or whatever it is that you're trying to do. And you can sort of like trust that it's going to work, especially if you get like the right scale.
So let's talk about products you love. Are there apps on your home screen that more people need to know about? Is there a product you use on, you know, every week that betters your life? Anything stand out to you?
I think the products that I use are pretty boring. I mean, they're known by everyone. I use Uber a lot.
Uber. I've heard of that.
Yeah, have you? Yeah. I use Yelp a lot. I use it in like the millennial way.
People like
to
hate on Yelp, but it's great.
I use Yelp all the time. I go to a restaurant. I don't know what I want. I look at the photos on the Yelp profile, pick what looks good. I use Firebase a lot for indie hackers. I'm a big fan of Firebase. That's a database application for, I think, building real-time web applications. It's great. I use another tool called Retool. I just started using. They do internal tooling. So if you have a business and you're building tools for yourself and you want to give other people in your company access to those tools, Retool is pretty great for that. I use Airtable, kind of the same idea,
same,
kind of a powerful spreadsheet application. A lot of internal tools in Airtable.
How do you use Airtable? Is it for
We use it for managing content on Indie Hackers. We use it for managing contractors that we work with. We've probably got like a dozen different Airtables, and they're all just basically databases that we use and we update on a regular basis.
By the way, Airtable is a great example of a product and a tool that's like subtly and secretly very powerful. And there's a bunch of different people. I don't know if you've seen this through Indie Hackers, but a bunch of people have built MVPs and products using Airtable without writing a line of code.
That's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a bunch of different use cases out there. Now they have something called Blocks. I should probably just add a disclaimer. Airtable is actually a sponsor, but that's not why I'm saying this. I'm a user of Airtable, and that's one reason why they are a sponsor, because we like the product. But they have a thing called Blocks, which have integrations. And so you can like tap into different APIs and, again, no line of code. So
that's cool.
It's pretty dope. What about you? What are you digging?
I mean, same. I don't think I've, you know, my sort of app record collection is very mainstream. You know, I'm going to be telling you about Pink Floyd and Nirvana. Pocket, I'm an obsessive user of, for, you know, so you don't have that feeling of like, you know, I got to read this article now in one of my 1700 tabs. You can actually, like, when you get on a plane, actually there's like perfectly curated magazine, you know, curated by somebody who sort of has very similar, oddly similar tastes to your own. Jump Bikes, it's the best way to get around the city. Sadly, their numbers are capped in many cities, but I think they're fixing that.
Owned by Uber as well.
Now owned by Uber. Exactly. So I guess in some sense, we're both recommending Uber. I love WhatsApp. I think it's just better than iMessage. You know, messages appear in order and stuff like that. MFit QS is a sleep tracker. It actually goes under your mattress. And I always kind of like the idea of sleep trackers, but like wearing a thing, it was kind of uncomfortable and felt like a lot of work. And so the MFit goes under your mattress. It gives me good analytics on the various ways in which I'm sleep deficient.
Has it changed the way you sleep, or the maybe how you eat, exercise?
I now feel more guilty. I think, you know, it's like the kind of dieting advice that, you know, the easiest and best way to improve your diet is just to like track what you eat. I think I now do feel somewhat worse when I get a bad night's sleep in such a way that I kind of prioritize it somewhat more. And I kind of feel this sense of achievement when I sort of get a good night's sleep. And so it hasn't, no huge changes, but I think it just has sort of elevated the priority for me.
Yeah. I haven't been tracking my sleep. I just know when I sleep terribly. And today was one of those days where you wake up at like 4:30 for no reason.
Oh, you seem very coherent to us.
I don't know. Well, 5:30 is my normal wake up. So it's like, well, you know, I'll be waking up an hour anyway. Thanks for having me over. This is a pleasure to chat, and cool to see the new office.
Thanks for
space.
Having us on the show.
Yeah, thanks for interviewing us.
Thanks. See you guys.
See ya.
Bye, Ryan.
Thanks for tuning in. We'll be back next week. But in the meantime, share the podcast with your friends on Twitter and tag a guest you'd like to hear in a future episode. See you soon.